that spirits are incorporated in all material beings was true, and also that communication can be had with these spirits through sacrificial offerings. The fatal falsehood was that that spirit world consisted of powerful spirits of good that brought happiness to those who worshipped them. Once the evil spirits had convinced their adherents of this, however, it 151 was just a step away from human sacrifice. The parents of children who were to be sacrificed were told that after their child's death, its spirit would constantly be around them and bring them good fortune, but that both they and their child would experience the most dreadful things if they refused the idols this sacrifice. Obsessed as they were, they always gave way in the end. You need not wonder at this, for during the rites performed before the idols and at idolatrous gatherings generally, the evil spirits announced these doctrines through their trance mediums and supported them by the exhibition of miracles that accompanied their discourse. Not infrequently, the idols themselves spoke. Such speech was a direct voice produced by the low spirit world with the aid of the odd of the sacrificial offerings and that of the mediums in attendance. God permitted this because He allows complete freedom within the limits that have been set also for those who are evil. The cause of apostasy from God was then, as it is now, the craving for worldly success and prosperity. Only in those days the prerequisites for communicating with the spirit world were well known, while today they have fallen into oblivion. Consequently, apostasy manifested itself in those times not only in inner defection from God, but in deliberately fostered, humanly perceptible communication with the evil spirit world through spiritistic idol worship. Inquiring of the dead was a daily need of the worldly minded, as inquiring of God was an integral part of the worship of the faithful. The messages sent by the dead through their mediums were such as to flatter the human passions of the recipients. Everything they heard was pleasant, and so they had no desire to listen to God's instruments, the good mediums. What the latter had to communicate to them at God's behest was too bitter for them. For it is a rebellious people, with children who turned out badly, who will not hear the commandments of the Lord. They say to the seers, "Do not see," and to God's prophets, "Do not prophesy the truth for us. Prophesy pleasant things, prophesy deceits, leave the right way, depart from the righteous path. Don't bother us with the Holy One of Israel." Isaiah 30:9-11. They wanted to hear only pleasant things, especially such things as would further their worldly interests. They wanted to communicate with specific spirits, as Saul wanted the spirit of Samuel to appear when he consulted the witch of Endor. Good spirits will not allow themselves to be summoned at the whim and pleasure of men. They come of their own accord with God's sanction, or, in certain cases, at His express command. However, they come only to those who seek God, in order that 152. They may show them the way to Him. Which good spirit manifests itself is not for man to determine, the decision rests with the good spirit world. Also from the evil spirit world not always those come whose visit people desire, for they, too, may communicate only with permission. The low spirits will, however, invariably claim to be the ones that were summoned, whether or not this is true, for they are spirits of falsehood whose only concern is to tell their adherents what they like to hear. It is, therefore, an act of great folly for people to arrange among themselves that whoever dies first will let the survivors know whether or not there is a beyond. Whoever enters into such an agreement, and makes his belief in a future existence contingent upon the fulfillment thereof, will invariably fail to receive the evidence he desires, for agreements of this kind are proof in themselves that these people lack a belief in God. Those who die without believing will find a fate in store for them in the beyond such that they will be in no position to communicate with the living. The spirits of the lowest spheres remember nothing at all of any such agreements. Even if they did remember, they could not leave the place to which they are confined because of their transgressions. Whoever believes in God, however, will be able, without any such agreement and without any conscious effort, to communicate during his lifetime with the spirits of his dear departed, if they too were believers. Here, too, the words of Christ apply: "First seek the kingdom of God and His justice, these other things shall be given to you as well." But there was no seeking of the kingdom of God by those who associated with the low spirit world. It was not their nature to seek God, they considered their worldly well-being only, and for this reason they refused to communicate with the good spirit world. The answers that they received from the good spirit world have at all times been too harsh and bitter for the ears of people who were enslaved by their passions. They regarded the utterances of God as an oppressive burden, even going so far as to describe the reprimands, warnings and threats pronounced by the prophets at God's command by the blasphemous phrase "the burden of the Lord." "What is the burden of the Lord?" was the usual question, whenever people wanted to know what the Lord had proclaimed. It was because of this that God sent them the message. When one of the people or a prophet or a priest asks you, "What is the burden of the Lord?" you shall say to them, "You are the burden of the Lord, and I will cast you off, says the Lord." And as for the prophet, priest or whoever of the people who says "the burden of the Lord," I will punish that person and his household. Thus should you speak to one another and among yourselves, "What has the Lord answered?" 153. Or "What has the Lord spoken?" But the expression "the burden of the Lord" you shall use no more, lest your own word become your burden, for you would have distorted the words of the living God, the Lord of hosts, our God. Jeremiah 23:33-36. Whoever, therefore, aspired to belonging to God's people was not allowed to have relations with the spirit world that had forsaken him. He was not permitted to inquire of the dead, for to do so was to commit high treason against God and to desert the truth. For truth was not to be found among the dead. The dead know nothing. What they utter is falsehood and deception, calculated only to drag the faithful down into the depths. Hence God thus admonishes his people, "Ask me of the things that are to come, my children. Let the work of my hands be left unto me." Isaiah 45:11. "It is I, the Lord, your God, who teaches you to do what will bring about your salvation, who leads you on the right path." Isaiah 48:17. "When they tell you to consult mediums of the dead and spirit experts that whisper and murmur, ask them, should not a people consult their God? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living?" Isaiah 8:19. "What? You want to befoul yourselves in the manner of your fathers and woo their monsters, too?" Yes, through the presentation of your offerings, by sacrificing your children, you befoul yourselves through all your idols down to this very day. And I should let you consult me? As sure as I am alive, I will not be consulted by you. Ezekiel 20:30-31. The Israelites had acquired the practice of inquiring of the spiritually dead in Egypt, and many of them had become addicted to idolatry. That is why the prohibition against inquiring of the dead was among the first injunctions laid upon them by God after their exodus from Egypt. "You shall not practice fortune-telling or witchcraft." Leviticus 19:26. "Do not go to mediums who conjure up the dead or to fortune-tellers. Do not consult them so that you may not be defiled by them. I am the Lord, your God." Leviticus 19:31. "If anyone consults a medium who conjures up the dead or a fortune teller to practice idolatry with them, I will turn against that person and drive him out from my people." Leviticus 20:6. "A man or a woman who has within them a spirit conjured up from the dead or a fortune teller spirit shall surely be put to death. They should be stoned. Blood guilt weighs heavily upon them." Leviticus 20:27. These passages show that the men and women who conjured up the dead were mediums through whom evil spirits spoke. These mediums were themselves responsible for their association with evil. They could have rejected evil had they turned confidingly to God and entered into communication with the good spirit world. Their punishment was therefore justified. 154. Besides the mediums, there were persons engaged in communicating with the evil spirit world through clairvoyance. Blood guilt here does not mean actual bloodshed or physical killing. In the Bible, the term blood guilt refers to spiritual slaying, or the estrangement of the spirit from God. The conjurers of the dead had indeed incurred blood guilt because they had brought those who came to them into communication with the evil spirits, thus leading them away from God and committing them to spiritual death. The contamination to which those who associate with conjurers of the dead expose themselves is not of a physical nature, but proceeds from the bad odd they absorb from the conjurers. It contaminates their own odd, making it a hotbed for the activities of evil spirit beings. There occurs in the Bible at least one detailed account of a case of conjuring, namely King Saul's inquiry of the witch of Endor. It is very instructive in a number of ways. Samuel had died, Saul had driven all the conjurers of the dead out of the country, but when the Philistine army invaded his land in great numbers, Saul was afraid and deep in his heart he trembled with terror. So he consulted the Lord, but the Lord would not answer him, not through clairvoyance, or the breastplate of judgment, or through the good mediums. For by his disobedience Saul had turned away from God. The spirits of God had left him, and an evil spirit had taken control of him. Then Saul commanded his servants to find him a woman who conjures up the dead. He wanted to go and consult her. As the good spirit world would not send him a message, he decided to try the evil spirit world instead. His servants told him that there was a woman in Endor who conjured up the dead. So Saul disguised himself and went to see her. He came to the woman by night and said to her, "Tell my fortune by conjuring up the dead. Bring me up from the underworld someone whose name I will give you." The conjurer did not want to do this, because she was afraid that she would be reported and put to death. However, Saul reassured her. So the woman said, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" "Bring up Samuel," he said. When the woman saw Samuel, she screamed and said to Saul, "Why have you deceived me? You are Saul." The king said to her, "Have no fear. What do you see?" The woman said to Saul, "I see a superhuman being rising out of the earth." He said to her, "What does it look like?" She said, "It is an old man coming up. He is wrapped in a cloak." Then Saul knew that it was Samuel. He bowed with his face to the ground, showing him reverence. Then Samuel said to Saul, "Why do you disturb me in my rest by bringing 155 me up?" Saul answered, "I'm in dire need. The Philistines are waging war against me, and God does not answer me. That is why I have called you, to find out what I should do." Samuel said, "Why ask me when God has abandoned you and become your enemy? The Lord treated you just as he declared through me that he would. The Lord has taken your kingdom and given it to another, to David. It is because you did not obey the Lord's command that he has done this to you today. And the Lord will let Israel fall into the hands of the Philistines along with you, and tomorrow you and your sons will be with me." I Samuel 28:3-19. There is much in this account that needs explaining, as you will find it hard to understand. Does it not strike you as odd that Saul trembled deep inside at the sight of the Philistine hosts? That was not at all like Saul, who was a brave man and had been in countless battles, always facing death fearlessly. Why then this sudden attack of trembling? It is what you call a premonition of death. The expression is not well chosen. It would be more correct to speak of a certainty of death. At the very first sight of the army of the Philistines, something within him told Saul that the hour of his death was at hand. That hour is indeed appointed for all by their fate. But what is the nature of this inner voice, that it caused Saul to be certain that he would meet death in the coming battle? What was the inner voice that called to so many of your soldiers in wartime, "You will not live through the next attack," or "You will not live through the day," or "This is your last leave, you will not return to your family and friends"? Why did so many soldiers, who had after all been home on leave often before, find it so hard to return to the front on the occasion when they would not return? In the case of Saul, as in all the others who know for certain that their death is at hand, it was the guardian spirits that made him aware of this most important hour in life. They have been sent to you as your leaders and friends. Often during your lifetime their voice has warned you of impending danger. They were your protectors. Often they have intervened in time to save you. But when the inevitable final moment of your life approaches, these spirit friends shake your innermost being so violently that the approaching hour of your death resounds in your ears too loudly to go unheard. Then you know that your time has come. Not in every case are the spirits allowed to sound this warning. When they are, it is a special mark of divine favor, granted to give the person to whom this warning is issued a chance to use the moments remaining to make his peace with God and implore his help for the fateful step into the beyond. 156. With Saul also it was the last appeal by God's spirit messengers, urging him to return to that God to whom he had become unfaithful. But Saul, although he knew he was about to die, instead of turning inwardly to God and renewing his oath of loyalty to him, at first simply went through the outward formality of calling upon God through mediums and asking for help with his worldly troubles. He sought no inner communion with God in repentance of his past behavior. Because of this, God did not answer his outward query, and Saul, fearing for his earthly life, sought out the conjurer. When Saul said, "I'm in dire need," he was speaking of the certainty of death that weighed upon him. I would like to take this opportunity to point out briefly the many other ways in which an approaching death is foretold. As you know, it is a popular belief that the howling of dogs, the appearance of certain birds, the turning white of plants, and many other occurrences are signs of an impending death. This is not superstition, as your scientifically enlightened age pronounces it to be. It is true, and even if such signs do not specify the person who is meant, everyone familiar with them should take them to heart and pause to reflect upon his own inner state. These signs are a call from your spirit friends, meant to remind you of God and the reckoning you must give him after departing from this earth. It is the spirit world that uses those animals as instruments, causing them to do the things that you regard as omens. As I have told you repeatedly, animals also may be used as mediums by either the good or the evil spirit world. The same is true of plants and flowers, but the spirit world employs such signs only when the people who see them are able to understand them, for it does nothing without a purpose. That is all I need tell you regarding this point. Coming back to the conjurer of Indre, it may appear strange that Samuel answered her summons at all. He was not one of the dead, not one of those who were separated from God. He was not one of the spirits of the abyss with which that woman was in the habit of communicating. He was one of God's good spirits. This fact the woman herself recognized from the superhuman size in which Samuel's spirit appeared. The appearance of the spirit of Samuel was God's immediate punishment for Saul's offense in consulting the powers of evil. If an evil spirit had come in Samuel's place, it would not have predicted truthfully the terrible fate awaiting Saul, but would have beguiled him with some pleasant falsehood. Hence it was God's will that the good spirit of Samuel should appear before the clairvoyant, who was likewise clairaudient, and through her announce to Saul what the coming day held in store for him. To learn this so far ahead of time was the hardest part of what Saul had to bear. Tomorrow you and your sons and a 157. Large part of your army will die. This prediction was the beginning of Saul's death agony, and it tortured his inmost soul until the hour of its fulfillment. Hence, on receiving the fatal message, he fell his full length upon the earth, horrified. What he had hoped to hear from the conjurer, namely, how he could best overcome his enemies, he was not told. Instead, the terrible fate that he did not want to hear was revealed to him as a punishment. In Saul was fulfilled the prophecy pronounced by God through the prophet Ezekiel, "If any one of the house of Israel, or of the foreigners who live in Israel, separates himself from me, and takes his idols into his heart, and sets the stumbling block of his iniquity before him, and nevertheless comes to a prophet to inquire for himself of me, I, the Lord, will answer him personally, and I will take action against that man, and will make an example of him and a proverb, and I will drive him out from the midst of my people, so that you shall know that I am the Lord." Ezekiel 14:7-8. The conjurer's recognition of Saul when Samuel appeared was due to her power of clairaudience, which enabled her to hear Saul's name when it was uttered by the spirit of Samuel. When Samuel further told Saul, "Tomorrow you and your sons will be with me," this is not to be construed as meaning that Saul and his sons were to share Samuel's lot in the beyond. All that Samuel intended to convey to Saul was that he and his sons were doomed to die on the following day, and that Samuel would be present to meet them as they passed over into the beyond. The spirits of the dying are met and greeted already at the deathbed by those who have gone before when they were close in life. They are also instructed and admonished by them, before they go to the place where they belong according to their lot. For the spirit world that goes without saying, Just as it goes without saying for you that you will meet your friends on their arrival at some foreign port to which you have preceded them. In spite of that, your fate and theirs in that country can be very different. The conjurer of Inda communicated with the dead by clairvoyance and clairaudience. She told those who consulted her only what she herself saw and heard. Other conjurers were true mediums, they fell into a trance and the foreign spirit itself spoke through them. Finally, when the text says that the spirit of Samuel rose up out of the earth, that is only how it appeared. To render itself visible, a spirit requires a cloud of odd, and it procures this odd from the odic radiation of the people who are present. The cloud of odd does not develop suddenly, but 158. Little by little, generally increasing in size from bottom to top, and this gives the impression that it is rising. Samuel appeared in the form of an old man, wrapped in the cloak he used to wear on earth, so that he would be recognizable. Spirits generally show themselves in an odic form that bears all of those distinguishing features by which they were recognized during their earth life. Just as you are able to choose your material garments at will, so spirits can give to their odic garments the character they consider best adapted to their purposes. Inasmuch as the laws governing communication with the evil spirit world are the same as those that apply to communication with good spirits, you find in the biblical reports that the same means were employed in consulting the dead that were used when inquiring of God. In both cases you find mediums acting as bearers of the required odic force, whether they were prophets of Baal or prophets of God. In both cases animals are sacrificed and incense is burned to increase the odic power. In both cases sites are selected that are free from disturbances and where the unfavorable effect of light and heat upon the condensation of the odd have been eliminated as far as possible. On this account the Bible damns the places at which communication with evil spirits was held along with the idolatry itself. My people inquire of their piece of wood. They expect their rod to foretell their future. For the spirit of idolatry has beguiled them, they have left their God and practice idolatry. They sacrifice on mountain tops and let incense rise from the hills, under oaks, poplars and terebinths, whose shade is so pleasant. Hosea 4:12-13. Everything that you learn from the Bible about the dead points to the fact that the dead are the powers of evil. Whoever joins these powers separates himself from God and suffers spiritual death. Israel was great, but when it sinned by serving Baal, it began to die. Hosea 13:1. You must not think, however, that the worship of Baal consists solely of peoples making real idols and deliberately seeking association with the evil spirit world, as was the case in ancient times and still occurs in the idolatry of some peoples today. Rather, idolatry is any state of mind that excludes God from our lives, that turns wholly to material matters, and that, under the influence of evil, replaces God with worldly considerations. Mankind of today is no less idolatrous than the people of whom the Bible speaks, even though in so-called cultured areas idols of wood or stone are no longer erected. Today's idols are in people's hearts, they are money, honor and worldly prosperity. As many sacrifices are made to these idols today as to the visible idols millennia ago, it is to these modern idols that 159. Millions of adults and millions of children are sacrificed each year, though in a less crude manner. The evil spirit forces of the kingdom of the dead rule over the far greater part of mankind also today, and what the prophet Micah said of the generations of his time is equally true at present: the faithful are gone from this land, among men the honest are no more. Everyone is on the lookout for evil deeds, each one ensnares the other. Their hands eagerly reach out to do evil, the prince makes demands and the judge is had for a price, the powerful one says what he wants, and between them they arrange things. The best of them is like a briar, the most righteous are worse than a hedge of thorns. The day that has been foretold by thy scouts, thy day of judgment, is coming, it will be a day of dismay for them. Put no trust in a comrade any longer, have no confidence in a close friend. Against her who lies on your bosom guard the portals of your mouth. For the son disdains the father. The daughter defies the mother. The daughter-in-law defies the mother-in-law. A person's enemies are those of his household. But as for me, I will look to the Lord, I will put my trust in God, who is my help, my God will hear me. Micah 7, 2-7. But God will be merciful even to mankind of today. He will see to it that they enter into communication with the good spirit world and thereby be raised from the dead. It shall come to pass that I will pour out my spirit world upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, your old people shall receive revelations in dreams, your young people shall see visions, even upon the servants and upon the handmaids will I pour out my spirit world in those days. Joel 3, 1-2 in the Catholic Bible, Joel 2, 28-29 in the Protestant Bible. 160. Part 3. Spirit communication in the post-apostolic age and in modern times. 161. Introductory remarks. After I had received the teachings set down in the second part of this book, relating to the laws of spirit communication and to the manifestations recorded in the Bible, it was left to me to study spirit communication in other ages of the history of mankind and to compare it with what I had learned from the spirit world. I was urged to investigate especially what goes on at the spiritistic seances of today, as well as what modern science has to say about mediums and the messages delivered by them. I would gladly have investigated also the writings of the past by ancient authors, pagan as well as Christian, insofar as they dealt with communication with the spirit world. For this I would have had to study the works of the ancient Greek and Roman philosophers, poets and historians. I would have had to go through all the writings of the church fathers and of ecclesiastical authors, from the post-apostolic age down into the Middle Ages, not to mention the works of the mystics. I could also not have ignored the innumerable accounts of the lives and accomplishments of the Catholic saints if I hoped to lay claim to an exhaustive study of the subject. Furthermore, I would have had to sift through the enormous amount of material contained in books and periodicals on modern occultism. At the very first glance, I was forced to admit to myself that such an undertaking would require the labor of a whole lifetime. I therefore decided to add only 3 chapters to this book. In them, it was my intention to show briefly on my own that spirit communication was a generally known and accepted fact in the post-apostolic age, and that it is practiced also in the present day, even though it may not yet be accepted by the people of today, and that, furthermore, it proceeds according to the same laws as those set out in this book, which have been the same throughout the past and will remain so forever. Thus the following chapters came to be written: Spirit Communication in the Post-Apostolic Age, the part played by the spirits in the lives of a Protestant and a Catholic clergyman of the 19th century, and Spiritism in the light of modern science. 162. Spirit Communication in the Post-Apostolic Age. 1. When a thing occurs of which we want to say, see, this is something new, we find that it has existed for a long time, in the ages that preceded us. Ecclesiastes 1:10. Between the pagan world, into which Christianity emerged, and Christianity itself, there waged a mighty battle. In this life and death struggle, the Christians of the post-apostolic age generally believed that the powers of evil were the true rulers of all paganism, and that the worldly rulers and their subjects were nothing more than the instruments of those evil powers. Hell saw its former dominion over mankind threatened by the good spirit world, which made itself known in Christianity. It now faced battle with a prince greater than the Roman emperor, and with forces stronger than his lieutenants and officials. The might of these forces had been at work even before the birth of the Roman Empire, and it extended to Rome's dark provinces, where Roman authority existed in name only. It extended also into people's hearts and thoughts, which are not subject to any authority. Wynal, p. 2. In the life of the state as well as the lives of individuals, there were many ties to this world of spirits in the beyond, whom the heathens called gods, heroes, or demons. To the life of the state took place largely under their auspices, and a great part of the public communal ceremonies with offerings and festivals was devoted to their worship. 3. Wynal, pages 2-3. Although their idols might to all outward appearances be dead things, people were convinced that behind these statues of stone and wood there existed real spirit beings that could make themselves known. The Christian martyr Justin says of them, "Those images bear the names and shapes of evil spirits that have appeared. It was these demons that the heathens worshipped,